I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more notable books of the season is the new biography from Cheryl Grace, Tiff, A Life of Timothy Findlay. It is the first full biography of the Canadian writer, and an eminent case is made that he is one of the country's more important writers. His works include the novels The Wars, Famous Last Words, Not Wanted on the Voyage, and The Piano Man's Daughter, and more, including television and theater. Cheryl Grace joins me now to talk about the research and writing of this book, as well as the insight she gained on Findlay through the people she talked to in his life, as well as his diaries. I'll ask her about Findlay's legacy and how he's been viewed by his contemporaries and by readers. Cheryl Grace is a University Killam Professor Emerita at the University of British Columbia. She specializes in Canadian literature and culture, and the author of books, including Inventing Tom Thompson, Canada and the Idea of the North, Making Theater a Life of Sharon Pollock, and Landscapes of War and Memory. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and an officer of the Order of Canada. This new book is published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Cheryl Grace. Professor Grace, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
So your publicist sent me the galley, I guess, back in late spring, I think it was, or was it early summer? I can't remember now. Anyway, time has sort of, you know.
I know, me too. Early summer, I think, Joe.
So I read the book with great interest, because I must admit that I there was one class in university where we had to read Elizabeth Rex. But other than that, I haven't read anything by Findlay. But I'd see him on talk shows. And I've been doing this for a while now, and I remember as a kid seeing him on television or hearing him on radio, and found him just utterly fascinating, just a character in of itself. So this was fascinating to read your book and get an insight into the work itself. So do you remember what of Findlay's you read for the first time, say, or when that was?
It would have been The Wars, and it came out in 1977, and I read it very, very soon, you know, after its publication. And I certainly began teaching it fairly soon after that, too, as soon as one could get it on courses and so forth. And so, yeah, my acquaintance with Findlay's fiction came in 1977. Now, I did see, believe it or not, a production of Can You See Me Yet with the incomparable Frances Highland. That was his first play. And it went up in Ottawa in 1976 and died because it got some bad reviews, and one bad review kills a play. It's a terrible fact of theater life, but I think it's a fine play. Anyway, I remember that play, and I remember Highland in the play. But the novel I began with was The Wars.
And as someone who has taught writing, as you have, what is his, how do students, say, react to his work? Whether it's The Wars or Famous Last Words or some of his better known novels, if you will.
Well, and as I do say at the beginning in my introduction, I decided to write, well, several things led to my decision to take on this 10-and-a-half-year task of research and writing of this biography. But certainly one of them was a seminar I taught graduate students in 2007, I think it was. And, you know, these are people in their early to mid to maybe even later 20s, so completely different generation from mine. And they didn't know much Findlay. They hadn't had much of his work, never seen one of his plays up. And I was just intrigued at the reaction of these people. They seemed to, what I would say, just get it. He resonated with them. He resonated with things they were seeing in the world around them. And they had training at the graduate level to deal with more complex narrative forms, which delighted and frustrated and bewildered and enchanted them. So it was that reaction. Here's somebody 25 telling me, and I was in near retirement at that stage, and thought, my God, if people this age are having this reaction, and they're asking me questions that I can't answer, in particular questions about, well, who is Finley, and you know, why is, you know, where's this coming from, and da 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 da.
Yeah.
I couldn't answer those questions. But if young people come to you with that kind of enthusiasm and curiosity, it's a signal. And so I started looking around, asking colleagues, you know, where's more information, where's more biographical information on this man?
Yeah.
There was very little there. And so I looked into the realities of the situation, and that means, where are his papers? Do they exist? Where are they?
Mm-hmm.
How voluminous are they? And therefore, what am I facing? And then the next step has to be very practical again, because I had to go and find Bill Whitehead, his partner, and meet with Bill Whitehead and find out whether Bill Whitehead would be on side. And to be on side, I had to have his written permission to gain access to a whole mass of restricted documents in Library Archives Canada. And without that, there's no point taking on a really very important task like this, writing the life of an important writer.
Yeah.
And Bill Whitehead, who has now passed away, and I miss, was amazing throughout. He didn't block me at any point. He didn't say, no, you can't do that. He read the manuscript in its penultimate form and called me. That was very moving.
Yeah.
And but I went to meet him in Stratford in 2010 because, again, you can't take on this responsibility. You can't apply for funding, which I was desperately going to need.
Yeah.
If you don't have that kind of really carte blanche permission, which he gave me. And then he gave me much more. I've got things here in my study, which I'm looking at right now, carefully packed away, that are irreplaceable documents, which he gave me. And eventually they'll go to an archive. But, that's a long answer to your question, but it was that part itself was an adventure, you know?
Yeah, so I'll ask you about the last 10 and a half years. But the first question I wrote down as I was preparing for a chat the other day, writing out my notes, was whether Finley was still relevant or why a biography on him. And then, so I just the other night went back to the book and, you know, started reading parts of it to jog my memory, because it's been several weeks since I finished it, and you can't help but realize how relevant he is. He died 18 years ago, but this is a life that, even when we're considering the pandemic, or we're considering conflict around the world, or the state of say Canadian literature, it's almost shocking. Or surprising that this life it remains relevant today. It's something that you can read into today, pick up any part of the book and you know, compare and contrast to what's happening today in whatever aspect it is, the media, the CBC, censorship, you know?
Yeah, fake news. A plague, environmental degradation. No, I think that's what those 25-year-olds were in part telling me was, you know, this is the world, people, my generation, you've handed us this world, and look what a mess it is. And this man is showing us not only the mess, but he's also holding out hope for change. And so I couldn't agree with what you've just said more, and it does my heart good to hear it said. It can't be said often enough. Yeah, unfortunately or fortunately, and it's both, Timothy Finley is relevant. He would have been right there with Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what he would be doing, given what's happening in the United States.
Yeah.
Because so many of the things that he forewarned us about have come to pass. It's creepy, actually, and he wasn't writing. Maybe Not Wanted on the Voyage would be the one exception to this. He wasn't writing apocalyptic science fiction type stuff. His grasp on the reader, I think, is all the more profound, like The Ancient Mariner, because his novels are fundamentally realistic novels. They're based in fact, in history, in time and place, in characters who come alive on the page. And so it's creepy, yeah.
So as I said earlier, my experience with him was seeing him on television as a guest on talk shows or being interviewed or listening to him on the radio. And what struck me was that he was such a compelling figure to watch or listen to that you couldn't help but turn away. Was he the same in private, say? I mean, it seemed, and I'm giving away part of the book, but the Finley that I encountered, as I did, was a character that he was playing.
Yes. I've seen many of those interviews and listened to others that were taped, thanks to Bill Whitehead.
Uh-huh.
And some marvelous feature documentaries. The best one is by Terrence McCartney Philgate. And he began his creative life in the theater as an actor. He acted at Stratford in its first season, went on with Alec Guinness to act and live in London, England for 3+ years, and then continued to do some acting for a while after he came back to Canada. But he was always performing, and he was very, very good at it. He could give a talk and a reading that left you just kind of gobsmacked.
Mm-hmm.
I've listened to these tapes. I wasn't there, but you could hear a pin drop, and he's so powerful in his speech and in his passionate feelings about things, the clarity of his thought. But then when he reads from his work, it's amazing. So was he performing in private? You mean in all those thousands of pages in his journals, which he kept all his adult life? Yes and no. As a biographer, it would be all too easy to be sort of swept up and sentimental about it. I had to be very practical, and I was always asking myself, okay, Tiff, you are posing in front of this blank page as if it was a mirror. And then there would be another point where that wasn't the case at all, and he wasn't posturing or posing. He would be analyzing a piece of particularly classical music, which he loved. He liked all music, but he would analyze the classical stuff. There's an incredible analysis of Verdi's Requiem, which is, whoa, okay. And he didn't have any musical training. He played the piano by ear.
Mm-hmm.
Or he would be analyzing a piece of theater. Okay, I could see that because he was in the theater.
Yeah.
Or he would be analyzing painting. And he would have these insights. So he could be very objective in his journals, and he could be very performative about himself in his journals. And then there would be other moments when he would be actually practicing his own writing. And I do discuss this at some length in the biography, and I hope the reader will enjoy the journey with me. I don't want to give anything away right now, but gradually we will come to the point in those early journals from the 50s when Timothy Finley will say, oh, I'm not an actor.
Yeah.
I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And that trajectory is fascinating to watch that unfold in the pages of his journals.
Yeah.
How many of them. So he's, it's a mixture. He was a very complex human being, and highly sensitive, highly self-conscious, and often very, very lonely. So the journals, particularly in those early years, were a companion. Later with Bill, he didn't need that form of companionship, and the journals become much more involved with his creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm talking about the journals from the 70s and the 80s and 90s.
What as you're reading the journals, because that's people don't keep diaries anymore, or they don't keep, I guess social media does that for you, I suppose. If you didn't have the journal, say, what would have been lost, or what sort of questions would you have had about his life that you couldn't find elsewhere?
So many. Where would I begin? Oh, dear. All right. I'll begin with family.
Yeah.
one could and shouldn't, but could, as a biographer, start reading from the fiction back into the life. That is one of the things you shouldn't do. The other thing, of course, is to speculate when you don't know, and that's a real no-no. But so much about his family and what they meant to him and how and why they meant so much to him is revealed in the journals. Now, some of it will be in Journeyman. He wrote two autobiographical works. One is Inside Memory, which is a brilliant, brilliant non-autobiography, fascinating.
Yeah.
And the other one is Journeyman, and he does talk about some family members in both of those volumes, but not to the extent that he does in the journals, and linking those family members directly with characters in his fiction so that you can see two things. You see the link, you see how important, but then you see this extraordinary imaginative creation of a fictional figure from the, if you will, the raw data of an actual life that meant a great deal to him. So you can't simply say, oh, this character is his father, this character is his Aunt Ruth, or whatever.
Yeah.
But until you know that they're behind that, noises off,
mm-hmm.
Backstage. You can't appreciate the artistry of the character you're reading in the novel or in the play. So all of that, if you didn't have access to those journals, and there's many, many more things. But there you have some of it. I hope in future that young scholars will rediscover Finlay.
Uh-huh.
Some people have told me they've already gone back to reading or rereading his novels. But I'm hoping in the future that some young scholar will be intrigued enough to get permission from the estate and go and look at the manuscript versions of one of his novels or two of his novels or a play or something and actually see the kind of hard work he went through.
Yeah.
Because he kept all his drafts.
Mm.
And Bill helped him do that. Again, that's another thing I note in the biography. But if you hadn't got those journals and those manuscripts, you'd really be winging it as a biographer. Not
yeah.
as a literary critic, necessarily, but as a biographer, you'd be winging it. You know.
Well, what's also fascinating is you write Finlay's life in the book. You give us the context of the times. And as one of the chapters... it's the golden age of Canadian writing, isn't it? I mean, these are heady
yeah.
times.
Yeah.
The writing, not only his, but of his contemporaries, are of what Canada's about or trying to get to the idea of what Canada's about. What is it like to look back at that era and see where, say, Canadian literature has, say, evolved to today?
Well, there, of course, as a student of Canadian literature for decades, I'd have to say there was Canadian literature
yeah.
prior to 1975, let's say, of course, or even 1972, if you go back to some of Margaret Atwood's early work. But there was Canadian literature. But there's a real flourishing and a real support amongst writers, of other writers. That's when the Writers' Union of Canada will be
mm-hmm.
formed. And kind of an excitement that they generated for and amongst and between themselves. Graham Gibson, the late wonderful Graham Gibson, would be the sort of moving force behind the formation of the Writers' Union of Canada, which then Margaret Lawrence, now back in Canada, would... Anyway, that's all outlined in the in the biography. And Finley was in the right place at the right time to get the kind of support from fellow writers that he craved, that he hadn't had until that point. And when I look back on it now, it's amazing for what was achieved and for what they cleared the way for in terms of further achievements and expansions, which brings me then to a rather sad, in some ways, it's both sad and wonderful, observation that Finley foresaw once more in a speech that he gave, Joe, I hope I'm remembering, it was the speech that he gave at Duthie's, our wonderful Duthie's, when we had Duthie's.
The long-lamented Duthie's books downtown.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That he said, you know, in a few years I'll just be another dead white male. Gay. Or did he say homosexual? He preferred the term homosexual. Oh, my God, what could be worse? I have him on a tape saying that. Mm-hmm. Another dead white male. Who gives a damn? Well, that's happened. You know, dead white males are out of fashion. And the writers who stepped up with wonderful things are not, they're not dead, they're not white, and they're often not male. And that's wonderful, and that's great. I just hope that room is still possible for a dead white man who wrote as much as well as Timothy Finley and had as much to say about the world we've created and almost destroyed as Timothy Finley. There needs to be, if there's good writing out there, there should be room for it.
Yeah.
And, oh yeah, that was the Duthie's lecture. Oh no, I'm not going to give it away. Somebody should read it. You read the biography.
He did.
There was a performance. You ask about did he perform in public?
Yeah.
It was a performance.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning of the book, you refer to a review that he wrote of a biography of Glenn Gould, in which he describes, say, the nightmares of a biographer. It's a long process to write a book like TIFF. Did you experience any of those? I mean, what was the process of research and writing like for you?
Well, that's the part that I like the most, I suppose. It's getting a book through the final stages that are exhausting and ruin your eyesight and your back and so on and your patience,
right,
et cetera. I love the research. I enjoyed the research for this book. I visited many archives. The other thing I do, and not just for biography, but for many of the other books I've done as well, I do what I call field work, simply because I'm actually literally going out into the world somewhere. In this case, the main place, the first place to go is, of course, the farm where he and Bill lived, where Bill Tiff did so much of his, most of his writing.
Uh-huh.
And he called it Stone Orchard, a name redolent of all sorts of allusions, which are mentioned in biography.
Yeah.
But just to walk in those fields, to go into that house, I mean, I was very, very blessed in the people I met who welcomed me and helped me. And they're thanked at length and most sincerely in the book. But I visited Stone Orchard and Cannington several times. I visited places in the States, in England, of course, in London, and in France. I found his place in Provence, and again, trespassed down a driveway, and the people living in that place right that day when I was there, I said who I was. Oh, do come in.
Yeah.
I mean, how lucky is that? I trespassed into a gated community in Maine because I was there on the Canadian taxpayer's dime. I wasn't going to go away. There was a path down to the beach. I took it. I took pictures. I came back up to find somebody waiting for me.
Yeah.
But when I said who I was and why I was there, it took me another 3/4 of an hour to break free. So again, I didn't get hauled off to the local jail. I was just warmly welcomed in instances. Archival research is exhausting,
uh-huh,
working under pressure and financial constraints, and it's a huge responsibility. The restricted reading room at Library Archives Canada is a challenge in itself because you're closely supervised by uniformed guards, and who will slam a box closed if you've left it open on the desk a moment too long.
Yeah.
Other archives were more fun. The one at Guelph, the University of Guelph archive, that's delightful. Yeah, interviews, of course. Lovely, lovely people interviewed. Field work, which I enjoyed. Archival work, which is essential. And there weren't nightmares, but there were challenges. And there were some people who wouldn't talk to me, and that is their prerogative.
Yeah.
There were people who died before I got there, as Tiff notes in his review of the Glenn Gould biography. And then there were things I could never know. And mentioning Glenn Gould, you know, he and Gould, you know, Gould was a terrible night owl using the telephone.
Uh-huh.
And so was Finlay. And they would talk at 2 in the morning. And nobody recorded those conversations, damn it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there are all sorts of things that you cannot know as a biographer. And you just wish. But there it is. That's it.
There's a delightful moment that you describe in the book. Your own experience where, you know, so you go to these archives, you go to these libraries, and you have to be quiet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there were a couple of these times where, you know, you find something that's particularly exciting or that you know, that's a terrific insight into something that you're working on, and you have to censor yourself or mute yourself.
Well, there were a couple of occasions when I didn't.
Yeah.
There was a great shriek. when that happened in Library Archives Canada, thankfully there was no guard in the room at that moment,
yeah.
And the only other people were researchers who looked up at me rather, not admonishingly, actually. They smiled. Other researchers understand.
I'll bet.
But the really fun moment was in Toronto, in the Metropolitan, down in the basement in the micro film room.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not going to tell that story because it's in the biography.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. There's so many wonderful moments in the book, not just obviously of his life, but your own experiences, which I think are fascinating. I want to ask about Finlay's drinking and smoking, and whether that, I mean, that obviously had an impact on, say, the length of his life and the health of his life. Did that have any effect on his creativity, say?
I'd have to say no. I mean, in that sense, you may or may not be aware, but I did a lot of work earlier in my career on Malcolm Lowry.
Mm.
And I'd have to say that Lowry's alcoholism did have an impact on his writing, and it's tangible. But in Finlay's case, I would say no. First of all, the smoking. People smoked back then.
Yeah.
Everybody did. It's hard to remember those horrible days, but I'm old enough to remember, although I didn't smoke myself. As for the drinking, well, there were drinking issues in the Finlay family. So it wasn't just Finlay, and insofar as there's evidence to suggest that alcoholism will place. He was in a family where there were serious alcohol problems. He had an older brother who would kill himself with drink.
Uh-huh.
His father was a serious alcoholic, but that isn't what killed him. The brother Michael, it was. And there are certainly suggestions in many other places that other members of the family, on the Finlay side at least, had drinking problems. Not on his mother's side so much, on the Bull side of the family, but on the Finlay side of the family. But then again, people drank an awful lot more than they... Well,
yeah.
Do we still drink a lot? Not hard liquor, eh?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask, but
yeah, me too. Yeah.
In my case, I've been known to lift a few, but you are right that smoking and drinking were less. I guess were more conspicuous, I should say, in those
days.
Everybody
did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and did it to a excess.
They were in offices, you know, whatever offices they were. I'm sure they were in universities as well.
Oh, yeah. But he certainly damaged his health. His health in the last years of his life was really precarious,
The you mentioned a moment ago the his preference for the word homosexual rather than gay. He hated the word gay in terms of how to describe himself and would prefer homosexual. As I was thinking about that, I'm wondering what the difference is or why his preference, say.
Again, I can't answer that question from fact. There's one really very moving speech that he gave to the Psychiatry Association in Toronto. How would you like to be called gay? And the implication there, there are many things to take away from that speech that are quite clear, but in terms of the word gay, he saw it as a slur, as a pejorative term, and he also, I am speculating, saw it as an inaccuracy. I'm sorry, he was very fussy about language.
Yeah.
He was a writer.
Yeah.
He was fussy about punctuation. There's one letter in which he screams at an editor about every... No, I can't say that on your radio.
No, you're welcome to.
Every fucking and counts.
Yeah.
And it's there for a purpose.
Yeah.
And whatever. So, you know, he was very, very... And gay just rang poorly for him. He saw himself as homosexual. And he was quite content with the term homosexual. So what it meant to him, how it rings in our ears now, I'm so used to the term gay, and it would be the first thing that came to my mind or my lips or my whatever, my pen if I was writing. Not queer so much. I think that's a bit younger than I am, but not homosexual, unless you were in a clinical or medical or something like that. I don't know, you know. But... he preferred and spoke about himself that way with pride. So there you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really is, I think, his life. He had his alcohol. Yeah, he had drinking problems. It was illegal to be gay. He suffered trauma, his father, et cetera, et cetera. It's astonishing how he endured through some of that, which is incomprehensible to me, to I hope most of us these days, but not all. Homophobia hasn't gone away. This life is a love story and a success story. I feel. I hope.
And that's why I found it, looking back, well, at the time I read it, a few months ago now, and when I was looking back at it in the last few days, what I found exciting about it, because, you know, most, you know, we all think our own lives are interesting, and so to have to devote time to someone else's life might be challenging, but that's what I found exciting about your book, is that there's so many, there's no way that the story is not relevant, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the important word. He cared passionately about the environment, about many things.
Yeah.
And you mentioned some of them at the beginning of our talk, but I want to stress and leave the stress on this word environment. He was an environmentalist before we started calling people that. He fought for nature conservancy. He rejected organized religion in favor of this rather pantheistic, I guess, is rather old-fashioned word. Today... environmentalists and biologists and botanists call what we're suffering from nature deficit.
Mm-hmm.
We have lost our connection with the natural world, and hence we don't understand our own place within it and the damage we are doing to it, and hence the responsibility, etc., etc. Well, Finley was talking about that and pleading with us to reconnect and be more humble and recognize the sacredness of all living things and our connection with those living things before we destroyed the world. And he writes about our destruction of the world. Now, he does that most powerfully, I guess,
yeah.
Not Wanted on the Voyage, doesn't he? But he was doing it in stories. He was doing it in his other fiction, the stress that he would put positively upon the natural world rather than negatively upon what fascists and the rest of us were doing to the environment. But his praise is the positive thing. Use your imagination. Remember who you are, where you come from, what your roots are, your connection with the natural world, and use your imagination. To fail the world is a failure of imagination.
Yeah. I'm sure you're asked this a lot. If there was a book to say pick up of his that you know after reading your book, to want to get into his work, what would it be?
Famous Last Words.
Yeah, that's a book that I haven't read, but I've obviously heard alluded to over the years. Mm. And after reading your book, that's probably the one that I want to, some people might say, well, you start at the beginning, but I guess you go to Famous Law. You'd suggest going to Famous Law.
Everybody should do what they want. I was just talking to somebody who finished a biography and gone directly to The Piano Man's Daughter.
Mm.
And, zoomed with me to say, my goodness, this, that, and the other. Other people will go back and reread The Wars. Somebody, in fact, told me they had done that. But my personal go-to book, and I love The Piano Man's Daughter. I love The Telling of Lies. I love The Wars. It's endlessly teachable and fascinating and relevant, etc. But for my money, the book that deserves our attention right now is Famous Last Words. Mm. And the fact that people, artists even, will sell their souls to the devil. And that we need to stand up and protest while we still can.
Yeah.
Rather than to be passive in the face of violence and war and greed and bigotry. But then there are people who don't want to read about World War II or World War I. I happen to not be one of those people. But for my money, Famous Last Words is right up there with Under the Volcano and Ulysses and Absalom, Absalom. In other words, one of the great works in the English language of the 20th century.
Cheryl, I have been looking forward to talking to you for several weeks now since I finished the book. I've kept you longer than I said it would, but I took all afternoon with you. I so appreciate your time today, and congratulations on this book. It's a fascinating life, obviously, but your book is a tremendous achievement, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you, Joe. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and thank you for getting in touch. I appreciate it, and yeah, go out and read Timothy Findlay.
The book is called TIFF, A Life of Timothy Findlay. It is published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press. Its author, Cheryl Grace, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.